Interview with Ed Quawasser, November 30th, 2009, in New York City by Kenneth Durr. I want to start and get to how you came to the SEC. I don't have anything about your educational background. Can we start with where you went to school?
Sure. Kindergarten or...
Let's do college and law school.
Okay, I went to City College of New York, the Baruch School. I majored in economics.
Okay.
And then I went to Cornell Law School.
Okay. Was it fairly unusual for an economics major to go into law?
Well, I decided in my last year that you really had to be a really good mathematician to be a good economist, and I wasn't going to make that. So then I thought, do something that I could actually do, and law seemed like an interesting endeavor.
Now, did that point you towards securities law and things like that?
Well, during the summers when I was in college,
mm-hmm.
I worked for several securities firms. So, as an economics major and as someone who was just interested in the markets, I was was interested in.
Tell me a little bit about that experience, your internships or whatever those were.
Well, they were hardly internships in those days. I worked for an over-the-counter firm, and there were really just three people. And so, although I wasn't registered or anything, when somebody was out, I essentially had to do whatever had to be done, and sometimes trade the stocks and make markets. And then I worked for Bache & Company in their over-the-counter department at a time when Harold Bache was still there.
Hmm. So did you specialize in securities law then in Cornell?
No, they really didn't have any specialties.
Okay.
They didn't even have a course in securities law. So, but, again, it was just something, securities field was something that I was interested in. When I got out of law school, I actually did something entirely different. I worked for a small firm that was engaged in entertainment law.
Huh.
And so did, you know, copyright work and dealt with mostly rock and roll acts. Sort of strange. But I read in the Wall Street Journal that the SEC was looking for people. So I applied.
Okay.
And in those days, you needed to take a test. You'd go down to Washington and take a test, which I took. And then I guess I did well enough that I got hired.
Now, was this in the early 70s?
It was 67.
67, okay. Who was running? Was it trading in markets then, or was it?
Well, I actually was working at Opinions and Review.
Oh, okay.
When I started.
Tell me a little bit about the process of coming in. Interviewing and sort of looking around and from, you know, you had this complete other experience. Tell me a little bit about getting into the SEC and what was involved. What was the learning curve like?
Well, it turned out Opinions and Review was, even though we didn't fit because I was a lot more aggressive than a judge should have been. So I was sort of rooting for the home team. That probably wasn't appropriate, but you got to read all of the cases that the commission had brought in the years before to be able to write an opinion. So
okay.
It was a great learning curve for me in that I got to learn all of the things of which I actually knew nothing. I did know about the markets and I knew how to read, so I could read the statutes,
right.
But reading how the commission interpreted those and how the courts interpreted them was a really great learning experience for the rest of the time that I was at the commission.
And these were rules having to do with every aspect of the commission?
Yes. Whatever enforcement brought a case mm-hmm. against someone, there needed to be an opinion written. So it could be a fraud, could be market manipulation, there was an options trading case. So they were all different kinds of cases.
Okay.
So it gave at least a broad view of what was going on. And
was this in the general counsel's office?
Well, at that point, Opinion and Review was a separate office.
Okay. So that gave you a pretty good perspective on everything, I guess.
Right.
So how did that lead you into trading and markets?
Well, it's a long story. then I actually went to the Washington Regional Office, which at that time was in the home office. Mm-hmm. And I was doing the Regulation A work, you know, 33 Act stuff. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I went to Corp Fin in doing the Williams Act and Regulation A, because the Williams Act was just approved, and I guess they didn't know where to put it, so they put it there. And so I learned about the Williams Act and the tender offers and, mm-hmm. and that. And then I was asked by the Washington Regional Office to come back and be the chief regulatory attorney. So at that point, I was head of broker-dealer examination program, the investment company examination program, and the investment advisor examination program in the Washington region.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about, you did sort of Corp Fin type stuff, 33 Act
right.
stuff, and then suddenly made this transition into broker-dealers and things, which you obviously stuck with. tell me a little bit about that change and the kinds of things that you were looking at. You made that change?
Well, again, going back to the opinions and review, most of the things, the cases that the commission brought were dealing with broker-dealers, so I actually had a pretty good idea of how they operate and what was going on, and also I had worked for a couple of them when I was in college, so right. I had a fair idea of what was happening. And one of the things dealing with broker-dealers is the net capital rule. And it's hard to get lawyers to really be interested in that, but somehow I got interested in it, so I knew a great deal about that. So between all of those things, it was pretty easy to step in. And
was this a reorganization sort or a sort of a new capacity that the
It was. I think I was the first chief regulatory attorney. They reorganized the office. They had a chief enforcement attorney and a chief regulatory attorney.
What was driving that?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me a little bit. A couple of things I noticed that you were involved with in that area. And I guess one was working with broker-dealers and all kinds of things, but generally right. regulating broker-dealers.
Right.
So you've got things like examinations, I suppose you go in and do investigations, things like that?
Yeah, we had an examination program, so one of the things that we did was develop a syllabus for the examiners to go in, and, you know, what questions to ask, how to deal uh-huh. with that. We did the same for investment advisors and investment companies, because Washington region had Baltimore with T. Rowe Price, and they also had Philadelphia and Delaware, where they have a number of investment companies.
Okay. Now, at this point, are you in the headquarters or in the region?
The Washington region then moved across the river.
Okay.
So we were across the river.
Okay.
But because we were so close, we also commented on a lot of things that were being proposed in the broker-dealer area and the investment company area. And because we had done examinations, both investment management and trading, well, it wasn't trading, it was market reg at the time.
Okay.
Both thought it was valuable to get our input into what was going on, because we actually had been into broker-dealers, investment advisors, investment companies, and those people hadn't.
Right.
So
that was something that regional offices did, right?
Right, and they still do that.
Yeah. Did you work with other regional offices, compare notes, things like that?
Yeah, well, there was a Jim Clarkson, who's still at the commission, became sort of a coordinator for the regional offices. And So we did get together. You know, he got everybody together, and we were able to compare notes and do other things. But there are some small offices, big offices, and then there was the New York regional office, which, you know,
the big
carried one. A lot of weight.
Yeah. At some point, I guess at some point the SEC, the regional offices, are administering all of these exams. Is that right?
Correct.
Did any of that responsibility ever flow down into the self-regulatory organizations?
Well, there is no self-regulatory organization for investment advisors or investment companies. So
okay.
That was always only done by the commission.
Okay.
With respect to broker-dealers, self-regulatory organizations did have, I guess, the primary responsibility. Most of, but not all, the examinations that we did were for cause. So if you found, if you got a complaint, if you heard there was something wrong, then you would send the, send examiners in to look at whatever was going on. We always figured we were better than the mm-hmm. self-regulatory organizations.
Really?
Of course.
Did you feel that way when you're on the other side of the table?
Oh, absolutely not.
Tell me a little bit about net capital rules, and this appears to be something that only an economist or somebody...
Well, it used to be administered by the New York Stock Exchange, and then as the late 60s, when all of the broker-dealers were going out of business, the commission determined that the New York Stock Exchange wasn't quite regulating in a fair and even-handed manner, and they were letting people go, and that's because broker-dealers were going out of business, and so Congress passed something called the Uniform Net Capital Rule, which is administered by the SEC.
Did this go in about the time of the 75 Acts?
Or yeah, like around that? That time.
Okay. What was different about the Uniform Net Capital Rule?
It was uniform. So that the SEC set the guidelines, and everybody had to follow them, so that New York couldn't say, well, we'll pass on. You know, we know you're a good fellow, so we'll give you some more time to get into compliance. Everybody had to comply with one set of rules. So.
Okay. But the net that they had to hold back would have been proportional to the amount of business they did, I would assume.
Well, it changed. We got more aggressive. This was a little later on when actually I was head of that area at Market Reg, where there are two different kinds of requirements. Either you keep a certain percentage of your capital in good assets, or you have a certain percentage of the amount of money that customers owe you, and you need to keep that amount, and that determines whether you're in compliance with the capital rule or not.
Okay. So at some point, it appears that there was, I wouldn't say a loosening up, but an adjustment of net capital rules in order to bring more resources to bear.
And also, it really was whether they were too tough to, being too safety conscious, where firms had to hold a lot of money, essentially useless in their business, when it wouldn't have caused many more failures to have them hold less money. So like the bank reserves today, you know, where people are talking, well, you know, you need to have 8% instead of 6%. But at that time, it was determined that we would think it was 4%, and we can go to 2% without having any great increase in the loss of broker-dealers, loss of money to customers.
Did you do a study or something like that? Or how was that determined?
That's a good question. There was some study of the broker-dealers that went out of business, mm-hmm. but there wasn't any great economic... I don't think the commission had an economist at that point.
Okay. So this is just kind of rule of thumb stuff? Somebody saying, well, I guess we can drop the percentage.
Yeah, I mean, people commented that, you know, it was too much. Some people wanted 1%. Some people said, you know, 9%, whatever the number is. And you sort of could run the numbers and see if we went to 2%, would anybody be out of business?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the answer was no, we wouldn't have lost any additional broker-dealers if you change from 4% to 2%. Guys who go out of business, they're minus 100%. So it's, it's not really a problem.
It looks, looking back at the records, it looks like there's a general concern about smaller broker-dealers at this time. sort of, you know, trying, not worrying so much about the big guys, but trying to make sure that the things are
right.
Tell me a little bit about that, where that might have come from. What was going
well,
on.
It's mostly every Friday afternoon at the commission, we would put a broker-dealer out of business. It was sort of like one of the commissioners. At that time, all of the commissioners lived outside of Washington except for one, so they would all leave. There would be one left Friday afternoon. We would go have coffee and put this broker-dealer out of business because the way the rules work, essentially a broker-dealer has a week to try to, without having to tell anybody, mm-hmm. that you could... At some point, they have to gather up all of their customer assets and lock them up. So they got to make that calculation on Friday.
Okay.
So as of Friday. So by Friday, they know they can't make it. They sort of come in and you find out that they're out of business and they need to be liquidated. So clearly, there were a lot of small broker-dealers who were going out of business because they didn't have the ability that... And then you would have fine fraud because they're trying to do everything they can to get money, and one of the easy ways to do it is take your customers' money.
Mm-hmm. So these were the kinds of people that were coming in and meeting with you.
Right.
And you were you turning these people up from examinations?
Some of them from examinations, some of them because they were required to report, some of them because the customers are complaining mm-hmm. they can't get their money out.
So tell me a little bit about the transition then from Washington Regional into the headquarters.
Well, then the headquarters was coming up with something essentially called OC, which is now called OC, which then was part of Market Reg.
Okay.
And one of the persons who was supposed to head that went to the CFTC instead. And so I guess... They took me.
What does OC stand for?
Office of Compliance, Examinations, and Inspections.
Okay,
inspections
right.
and Examinations.
That's it.
It was, as I said, part of Market Reg at the time. And it's my understanding it was broken up because Laurie Richards and one of Chairman Levitt's assistants couldn't get along, so they... This is true.
Well, that's why things happen sometimes.
And so they split her off to be by herself. And,
okay. So you were brought in to sort of get this OC program
right.
up and running.
Right. And that was really a coordination effort of all of the regional offices. And at that time, it was only the broker-dealer examination program. It
okay.
wasn't the investment advisors and investment company.
About when is this?
81, I think.
Okay. Did you become an associate director at that point?
Well, Harold Williams wouldn't make me an associate director because he wanted me to go up and run the Boston office. And my wife's from Boston, and she wouldn't go on the penalty of death, so I said no. So he thought I wasn't a team player. But actually, I guess I was an associate, but I wasn't paid as one. Then when John Chad came in, that was like one of the first things he did. So.
Okay. How did this, the OC... administering this OC process, how did that pan out? Did you build it up over time?
Yes, we built it substantially. That it was became the largest part of Market Reg. And at some point, the net capital area was added again because I was the only lawyer who was willing to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the office at one time. And then we also had transfer agents and depository oversight added to the office, so we did all of those things.
So essentially, you're just sort of compiling information and evaluating it all the time.
Well, we're looking to see if there are problems, and two, we did a lot of different things. Like the Boston Stock Exchange had a clearing agency. And most of the small exchanges had clearing agencies, which were the only way they made money. But Massachusetts wanted to close the clearing agency. They didn't pay taxes or some deal like that. So we actually went to Massachusetts and explained why it was really important to keep clearing agency, because then you wouldn't have the Boston Stock Exchange, and something that's good for Massachusetts.
Right.
we were able to save the Boston Stock Exchange. We moved most of the work to Depository Trust Company, so they really kept track of all the securities, so we weren't worried about them losing them, but there still Boston still got paid some percentage, so that they were able to keep the exchange afloat.
That's not the kind of thing you think about when you think about compliance and inspection.
No, I know.
You're thinking much more, you know, punitive. Was there some of that, too?
Well, because we had a good grounding in broker-dealer, every time enforcement wanted to bring a broker-dealer case, they would pass it through us to see if we would object, because the commission, they knew the commissioners would ask us what we thought, so it was smart of them to get us on board before they went to the commission. So we did that, and we would recommend that broker-dealers go to enforcement if they violated, you know, they didn't comply with all of the rules, or if they were repeat offenders, we would make an enforcement referral or have the regional office make an enforcement referral.
How often would a broker-dealer come in and say, hey, we're not in compliance, call enforcement on us?
Never. But when they're out of money, at some point, they're either going to steal the money or they have to give up the ghost. So.
Okay. Do any notable examples of that stand out, of really working with enforcement through one of these broker-dealer cases?
One of the largest, until Madoff, largest SIPC liquidations was a firm called Bevel Bresler in Toledo, I believe. And the New York Stock Exchange had been in there for years. They never found anything. Our Chicago office went in there, and literally within 10 minutes, they found that the head of the firm had taken all of the money, which was at that time, I think, about $64 million. And so there was a lawsuit. The guy went to jail. The Chicago office closed down the broker-dealer. There was a big SIPC liquidation. And at that point, we also got involved with SIPC because they didn't want to pay because SIPC pays if you have money in the broker-dealer for securities transactions. Well, this guy was able to get a lot of money by essentially running a bank, by telling people that he would pay them interest on their credit balances, and so people would have money in the broker-dealer for years and years and years, never do a securities transaction, but they'd be getting, you know, I don't know, what time, 5% interest on their money. And so SIPC said they weren't going to pay, and we in the securities industry had to convince them that they should pay, because otherwise people would not have faith in SIPC, and they wouldn't know whether they were going to get their money or they're not going to get their money. And so the large firms came down to Washington and the commission, and we all pushed SIPC to pay under the circumstances. And then they still do.
You talked a little bit about the transition from Harold Williams into John Shadd. And was there a strategic shift in any of the things you were doing or any of the things that you were focusing on with that change?
Not really. First thing that happened within a couple of weeks was a firm called Drysdale Securities went out of business, and they were a government securities dealer. So we were able to interface with John to help him explain, you know, the difference between broker dealers and government securities dealers, and who's responsible, who's not responsible, and, you know. And so we had a good rapport with John, and he sort of essentially let us go. You know. Certain people had problems with him, but we never did, or I never did.
Was the implication that Harold Williams didn't let you go so much?
No, not at all. But John, who came from the industry, had an idea about who you should sue and who you shouldn't sue, and you know what was appropriate and what wasn't appropriate, and where the SEC ought to spend their resources, which was doing insider trading and not sue companies but sue individuals. Same thing that's happening now, essentially.
Right.
So that was one thing. One big thing actually did change now that you... And I don't know if you've heard of MOSS.
No.
That's Market Oversight and Surveillance System.
Okay.
And under Harold Williams, Congress had authorized at that time a lot of money, $12 million, for the commission to build a computer system to oversee all of the markets because they didn't think that the exchanges were doing a good enough job.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also under my jurisdiction. But when John Shadd came in, he wanted the self-regulatory organizations to do it. And so John Phelan, who was head of the New York Stock Exchange at the time, stepped up and said the New York Stock Exchange would develop a computerized system, then they would let all of the other markets, self-regulatory markets, use that system so that there would be an order trail of all of the markets, a single order trail, and there would be a computerized surveillance system.
Okay. How well did this MOSS system work? I mean,
well, it never worked because it we started out, you know, having setting up criteria for the system, and within a few months, Harold left and John Shadd came in.
Okay.
And so we had a report to Congress every 6 months, and we would report, you know, essentially what we were doing and what the SROs were doing, and originally it looked like the SROs weren't going to do it, and I guess they really didn't want the SEC overlooking their shoulders on all of the market trading. So, as I said, New York Stock Exchange came forward and said they would do it. They did it.
This is part of the whole national market system push kind of thing?
Well, this was a push for the SEC to oversee everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have essentially made a nationalized market. And
right.
Obviously the markets didn't want to do that, but it's expensive. And, you know, $12 million wasn't going to make it for sure. Even in those days.
Okay.
And so New York must have spent $150 million by the time they got finished, but they were willing to do that.
What was their system called?
ISIS.
Okay.
It was our system.
Okay. Yeah, right. Well, let's get to that. Talk a little bit about the transition from the SEC to the New York Stock Exchange.
Well, as a result of that case I was telling you about, we sent a very critical letter to the New York Stock Exchange.
Beverly Breslin. Oh, yeah, okay.
Saying, you know, you guys have been in there for years. What are you, stupid? You haven't. How come you didn't find this? And at least my understanding, the first thing that New York did was they wanted to have a private investigator investigate me because I must have been obviously some communist or something like that. But the Washington people of the New York Stock Exchange, you know, they had a lobbying office, you know, got back to New York and said, no, we think this, you know, this is a real criticism. And then John Phelan came down to Washington, and we met with him and my staff and a few other people. And evidently he went back to New York and had a big speech to the staff about essentially what I told him, and then like a month later they had some headhunter call me up, and evidently because John refused to, and was interested, so I don't know, and then they made me an offer which I refused, so they made me another offer, and then I went down there.
Okay.
Up here.
What did you see? What was the gist of your talk with Phelan as to what the problem
well,
was?
Well, it was a cultural problem that the staff of the exchange was actually very good technically, probably better than the commission people because they had people from the industry, that people had been there a long time, but they were afraid of the industry. And so they backed off. They would listen to the people without pushing further ahead, asking. Something came up, sort of like the Madoff thing, that where they never asked the follow-up questions. Well, these people never asked follow-up questions. And so I really told them, you need to change the culture of the place if you want to have a good regulatory program. If you don't want a good regulatory program, then, you know, you'll have these things coming up all the time.
These are the big brokers that they're not asking the questions to?
Just about any broker. I mean, but clearly the big brokers. Big brokers, were, you know, well, they're on the board. They would go and be able to walk into Phelan's office. You know, they had access, and the regulatory people didn't. And so...
Was there markets? Was there surveillance of the floor at that point?
There was markets. They had market surveillance and member firm regulation were the two, and then enforcement. So they had three regulatory.
Okay, so that pre-existed your coming in.
Yes.
Okay, so it was, you had the setup, but there was a cultural.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about how you dealt with that when you came in.
Well, when I first came in, actually, I set up something called Regulatory Quality Review, which was sort of like OC, which would, one, see that the regulatory divisions were doing what they said they were doing, and then, two, were they doing what they should be doing? So I did that for about a year. We set up a group. We, you know, made comments and made changes in how they operated. Then at one point, member firm regulation enforcement were together. Then they broke it up, and they fired the head of member firm regulation, and they asked me to take that over. Then we fired the head of enforcement, so I took that over. And then the head of the whole area left, and then I got the whole thing.
And this happened over a period of quite a few years, though.
No, about a year.
No? Really? Okay.
Yeah. A little over a year.
Right. What was going on all this time that people are coming in and out like that, or mostly leaving?
Well, it was only a couple of people. You know, it was the head of member firm regulation who really couldn't manage very well, and the head of enforcement who shouldn't have been the head of enforcement. There was real turnover of the staff in enforcement. We had to do something to deal with that. And then market surveillance was pretty stable.
Who was running that?
I believe Don Solidar at the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you put more resources into this?
We put a lot more resources into it. The first thing I had to do was explain to everybody that I would be the only one who was on the hot seat, that they needed to do the job. If Phelan was unhappy, he would call me, not them. And so the only people they had to answer to were me, and I expected them to do the kind of job I expected them to do. So that was one thing. Then we set up a lot more standards, so some of the people who had come there to retired because they didn't want to do all of the work that we now set up for them to do. And rather than just hire people out of firms who were essentially ready to retire, who had great knowledge, but...
Is that what had been done before?
Yes.
That's an important point, I guess.
So we started a training program. We would hire people right out of college, and we'd give them a year's training before we would send them loose. And so it took a while because they had to learn, but they learned the way we wanted them to learn, and so it became a much more aggressive force to deal with.
What kind of people did you look for to bring in and put through this training program?
We hired accounting majors, economics majors, people who seemed smart and were interested in the work. So it wasn't any particular major that we were looking for. We were looking for smart people who, you know, had some idea what the hell is securities, but not a lot, because, you know, how do you know?
So they weren't the types who might have ended up working on Wall Street anyway and maybe making a lot more money.
They might not have been.
Because that's one of the things that is, you know, I'm always wondering about, is when you've got somebody in this enforcement role, you know, who could maybe be making a lot more money not being in enforcement.
Well, people, you know, the white hat syndrome is really important. People like to be doing good, you know. and get paid a reasonable amount. It's not that, you know, I'm making nothing. They did okay, and the exchange had very good retirement programs, so it paid for them to go to school. If they wanted to go to law school or graduate school, it would pay for them to do that. It would, if you worked there for 10 years, they took care of your medical for life. So there were a whole bunch of things, the compensating differentials that made up for the amount of money that you could make.
So you started with member firm regulation, and Don Miloski, I guess, came in there more or less about the same time, same day,
I think.
And he was the one who was looking over all three?
No, he was only looking over enforcement and member firm regulation.
Okay.
Dave Marcus was.
Okay. And then very quickly, I guess, you took over. All of the above came under your purview.
Right.
So what was your title at that point? Was it a vice president kind of
thing? No, I started as a senior vice president.
Okay.
At some point it became executive vice president and then group executive vice president, but
okay.
I'm not sure exactly when.
The 80s, we had the big market break in 87. There's a lot of technology coming in. How did those kinds of things affect what you were doing?
Well, we tried early on to add a lot of technology to member firm regulation. And in those days, it was a lot harder. You know, laptops weighed about 30 pounds. You couldn't carry them out. So it took several years, but eventually we were able to put what we call the examination program, which when it was in paper, it was about 130 pages of things that the examiner needed to look at, to put that on the computer, to link up the computers with the home office so that they had questions or needed advice, they can get back through the computer, they could show what's going on in the broker-dealer to the people back at the office. And so that became a lot more automated. At the same time, market surveillance became totally automated in that, you know, doing a billion shares a day, it's hard to look at a piece of paper. And so we actually had, they still may have, probably not, two MIT statisticians on full-time consultants to come up with various statistical measures of, for insider trading, for whether a specialist is doing a good job, you know, all those kind of things that the exchange was interested in. We came up with various different formula and computerized systems to deal with that.
Were you building on top of ITS that was going in at this point?
Well, no, ITS was just it was a line among and between all of the exchanges.
Right.
This was just for the New York Stock Exchange. We would look, but use the audit trail that was in all of the, among all of the exchanges, and we had certain formula that X, the stock trades 1,000 shares a day, it trades 1,000 plus X, whatever X is, something we want to look at. The average price movement is 2%. If it moves more than 4%, something we want to look at. And if it doesn't hit either of those criteria, if you combine them and it does something, then we want to look at that.
Okay.
So those would, it would start pulling all of the things, and then we would go out to, if there was a merger, we would go out to the companies and ask them for all of the people who knew what was going on. So, you know, the lawyers, the accountants, the chairman of the board, whoever it was. We would then go out to the broker-dealers and ask them for the names of all of the customers that traded. And we built a system that would match all of the people who traded against all of the people who knew, but the system would also go into, you know, did they live in, if they didn't have the same name, did they live in the same zip code, did they go to the same college, were they in the same clubs together, and the whole, were they on interlocking boards? As much information as we can get to determine whether X person had access to the information. And if they did, we would write it up and send it to the SEC, and the SEC would bring their insider trading cases.
Were there, what were some notable examples of that when your program caught some violators that way?
Well, of course, we had, what's his name? Boesky. The only problem with Boesky is he had so many positions that it was hard to say which, but we kept on finding him. There are almost all of the SEC's insider trading cases come from the exchanges.
Okay. So that's moving. That's through the 1980s. Getting into the 90s, the idea of front running starts to come up, and I first noticed it in something involving Raymond James, Florida, I guess, or something like that. Tell me a little bit about why do you think that became, you know, that wasn't really heard of much in the 80s. Why did it become the hot issue in the early 90s?
Well, because there were larger trades going on, so they weren't trading in 100 shares anymore. And for instance, we found one where people in this building, the Morgan Stanley people, had a $1 billion trade for Kuwait. But they would trade it during the day, but in the last half hour they would trade it for their own account, then sell it to Kuwait. We also saw, because of the options market, people were able to go into the options market when they had an order, a large order in the stock, because they knew that it would move the market, and so the options had more leverage than the stock. So we also were in the stock option front running. You might have seen some of the releases that we put out.
So the idea being that you're not going to make that much by front running a few shares of...
Right.
So it has to be a lot or options.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was what was becoming more commonplace in the early 90s?
Well, we certainly thought that it could. And we saw some instances, and we thought that it was appropriate to deal with it on a proactive basis rather than to wait till there's a huge dust-up.
Right. Well, you got a huge dust-up with the Oakford folks. That would have been the first one. Tell me a little bit about how you found out about that and how that process played itself out. Oakford, you had some floor traders who were working with a small company.
Well, that was a long, twisted process. We saw that there were some floor traders who were getting paid, it looked like a percentage of the profit in a transaction. And so we went and tried to outlaw that. And then the members didn't think that was a good idea. They said that, you know, lots of members do it, it's okay. So we had a large task force of upstairs brokers, people from the floor brokers, specialists, trying to come up with some criteria that people could look to see whether it was appropriate or not appropriate. What we didn't know is that it turns out at least some of them were also, when they lost on the transactions, were paying part of the loss to Oakford.
Right, right.
I guess, you know, put it out of your head sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
And so we had, the committee came up with a formula as to what was appropriate and what wasn't. We filed it with the SEC. We actually sent the SEC a copy of the report that the committee made detailing what was going on. The SEC still won't admit that they ever looked at that, but nevertheless. And at some point, though, we found that, well, the IRS found that Oakford was cheating on their taxes.
Okay. So that was where it sort of got into the public, I
right.
guess.
Right. And then it was we sent people in to look, and they found a lot of non-timestamp order tickets, because before we would go in and it looked like they had sent the order down 5 minutes before the execution. But when we went in at that time, they were able to find a bunch of order tickets that were not stamped. So obviously they were stamped after. And so that's when the whole thing started to fall apart.
And then there was SEC did an investigation. The New York Stock Exchange did an investigation
yes.
as well, right?
Yes.
Did you work with? What did you do? Did you bring in a consultant,
well,
or how did that work?
They were investigating us.
Okay.
So
the exchange was investigating.
No, the SEC was investigating the exchange. The exchange
right.
was investigating the floor brokers.
Okay.
Now we did share information on the floor broker investigation.
Okay.
And we brought a number of cases, and the SEC brought a number of cases.
What did you learn? What did this process show you about what you could do to tighten things up?
You can't trust floor brokers. Well, it's very hard because you don't see what's going on upstairs. So they put phony timestamps on the orders. So if you ask for copies of the orders and you got them with phony timestamps, it would not be possible to determine that, you know, it was an on-floor trade. That's really, that was the gravamen, is that they were making the decisions on-floor, the floor brokers, because so that they had some time and place advantage over everybody else.
Right.
So the one thing you could do that we did is when we started to examine all of the floor brokers on a two-year cycle. Before, we didn't think actually they can get much trouble. So there wasn't a very systemic examination of these guys. So when you examine them on a two-year cycle, you could look at how they're getting paid and see if there was any sharing of commissions with the upstairs broker or anybody else. And that's all essentially that we really could do.
On a two-year cycle?
Yeah.
Okay, so one would think that it would be natural to speed up the cycle.
Oh, no, well, we had no cycle before.
Okay.
And so it really was a resource thing. Would you think it more important to go into Merrill Lynch, or do you think it more important to go into some floor broker?
Right.
And, you know, there were hundreds of floor brokers, so when we say a two-year cycle, we did one, you know, say half 1 year, half the next year, then the half again.
Because the big brokers, you would look at those every year, right?
Right.
Okay. Okay. So it's really a matter of catching these in-between folks.
Right. And, of course, usually you don't turn up with the same problem you had before. People are smart. They'll come up with another
right.
way to game the system.
Did you turn up, when you looked at the floor brokers, did you turn up things that the SEC missed or vice versa?
Well, we just had more of them because, you know, the SEC, you could see who Oakmont was dealing with, and so you knew who all of those people are. But there were several others that we saw that we turned up that the SEC didn't.
Different firm?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Other things that were going on, I turned up references to the large firm project, which the SEC basically did a big study of brokerages and things like that. And you apparently worked with them a good bit on that. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, we the New York Stock Exchange, were really the only people who actually knew how to examine a large broker. You know, we would send five or six people into Merrill Lynch, and they would be in there for maybe 3 months. And they would find things that the 200 auditors, that their accountants who were there for all the time, couldn't come up with. Because, you know, we were looking for certain things that would alert us, whereas it might not be material for an auditor of Merrill Lynch. Our theory was if it was off by 10 cents today, it could be off by $10 million tomorrow. So we wanted to know why it was off by 10 cents. The amount of money that something was off was really immaterial to the process. So we have developed a whole series of 130-page examination program where our people would go in and look at things that, from a regulatory perspective, we thought were important. And really, the SEC really doesn't have people who are trained to do that. They have a few people in New York, but that's about it. You couldn't send FINRA into, now you could because they have the New York people, but you couldn't send FINRA into Merrill Lynch and ask them to do an examination. They wouldn't have a clue how to deal with Merrill Lynch's net capital, you know, $7 billion and things like that. So we work very closely with the SEC on all of their special exams where we would go out, sometimes we would go out with SEC people in the same examination team to look at whatever the thing of the day was.
Mm-hmm. Did the SEC, so essentially you're sort of doing a lot of the legwork for the SEC,
right,
helping them get the kinds of information. Did the New York Stock Exchange, your enforcement group, did you benefit at all from the findings after these big studies were done and sort of the intellectual work was done?
Well, the enforcement people would bring enforcement cases, you know, when they got a referral, several ways. The bigger cases came on referrals from member firm regulation,
right,
where they went in and said, you know, we found that, pick on Morgan Stanley, they didn't have, they didn't send out prospectuses for 3 years because they got screwed up on something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then enforcement would bring a case.
Right.
We also had a system set up where firms are required to self-report on certain things, and they file those through enforcement. So enforcement had a group that would look at all of those filings to determine whether there was something that we should follow up on.
Okay. I guess I'm trying to get a sense of development. How, you know, something like the large firm project, I guess, was the idea was not just to find people, but to somehow build a more effective program and to keep pace with the change in the industry.
Well, one of the rationale is that the SEC wanted a rationale to go into, literally, to go into the examinations because they wanted more resources. And so that was an excuse, frankly, to go into 50% of the large firms rather than 25% of the large firms, based on nothing that I could ever figure out other than they wanted to do that because they wanted to be involved from the get-go. So a lot of those things are really meant to increase the resources of the SEC as opposed to the SROs.
So there was no great sort of strategic insight that came out of all of this?
Not that I know of.
Okay. How about on your own, from you've been doing this then at this point for 10 years.
You know, one of the major things were derivatives, so that we can understand, you know, what the firms are doing with derivatives and how that affects their capital. And so we went to all of the major firms and we asked them to put on classes for us so we can understand it. And most of them were pretty accommodating. You understand it, stood it at least while you're in the room.
Right.
When you left. But Congress sort of took that out from under us by saying that swaps were not securities, not equity securities, and they didn't have to be in a broker-dealer. So essentially almost all of the firms moved those out to special entities that weren't under our jurisdiction.
Another big change was moving, first the exchange moved to 16ths and then you moved to decimals. And I assume that really changed the way things were done. Before.
Well, it changed business for sure, both upstairs and on the floor, because market makers could no longer make money. So it was a big deal. Upstairs firms made many fewer markets, because, you know, you made money on the spread. The spread's a penny, not such a great deal. And it also, as any economist would have told you, as the price gets closer, the quantity gets smaller, right? If I'm willing to sell 100,000 when there's an eighth market, but I'm only willing to sell 2,000 when it's a penny market, because, you know, if I put 100,000 at a penny market, I'd, you know, it'd go down to there. So it became harder for institutions to buy because the quoted market became very small. It went down, but the average spread went down 50%, and the average quote went down 75%. The average quoted size went down 75%. And so it surely changed the market and how people, from a business perspective, operated, but it didn't change much on the surveillance side. And we still had, we just changed, when something was an eighth, we made it a nickel. So if there was a nickel movement, we would, or a dime movement, depending on what it was. So we just changed the criteria of our surveillance to decimals.
But given this big shift in the way the market worked, did you find that people were doing different things or trying to game the system in different ways?
Not so much game the system as not do such a good job, in that they weren't putting up big quotes. They wouldn't take positions that they had taken before.
Specialists?
Yeah. So, you know, the specialists before might have been willing to carry an inventory of 100,000 shares or something. Now they may only be willing to take 10,000 shares of something. So it was more from the business side. The business people had to deal with the specialists. We dealt to some extent with that when we determined whether the specialists are doing a good job. You know, some of our criteria are, does a specialist stand up when somebody comes in with 100,000? One of the things we measured was the movement per X number of shares. If shouldn't have much movement. The best market is no movement, right? So if somebody comes in with 100,000 shares, want to sell at 10, you sell 100,000 at 10. If he ends up selling 10,000 at 10, 20,000 at 995, 70,000 at 990, that's not such a great market. And so those are the things that we looked at. But it was really wasn't from a regulatory point of view so much as from a business point of view.
Okay. But there were implications of that, in that you started to pick up the specialists doing front running, getting in between trades, things like
that. Yeah, well, I would love to say that was a result of decimals, because we looked, but it wasn't.
Really?
To my surprise, I said, it must be because of decimals. No, they seem to be doing it before decimals.
Okay. Did it just come was there just a notable case that sort of led to unraveling the threads, or what?
We had one of our analysts picked up in analyzing one of the specialists. He had a complaint about something entirely different, but so he decided to look at what the specialist did that day, and he was able to see that the specialist was coming in between market orders, which should be matched off against one another. So then we took that and we decided to examine all of the specialists, which we then proceeded to do. And then one of the firms fired one of the specialists, who was the specialist for GE, and that got in the paper before we were able to really complete the investigation. That's when the SEC came in.
Okay. And the SEC, sort of the same process, I guess, as 10 years earlier.
Yes.
Again, were there any systematic changes that came out of that process that you learned?
They changed the ability of the specialist to step in between electronically, that the orders would be matched off, so that specialists didn't have the ability to, unless the specialist put some note in a, you know, because sometimes you might have done a trade on the floor while electronics and the market really should have moved, but the specialist would have to put a note in the comments section in order to do that, so it would be easy to follow every time that there was a note. So,
so you turned to the technology to make this basically impossible to do.
Right. We thought, originally, we just didn't think the specialist would do that, frankly, because the marketers would show up in yellow, so all you had to do was, you saw the yellow at the bottom of the book, and all you had to do was match them, and that was there before. So all we were able to then put in is prevent them from not matching them.
Okay.
We always figured the specialists made enough money that, that they didn't need to nickel and dime
people. Not the same as the floor brokers, I guess.
No. Floor brokers are a small business, and the specialists are big business. You know, the specialists are Goldman Sachs, and Bear Stearns, and you know, various different other big broker-dealers, so that... you know, it turns out somebody wants to make money because the specialists got paid on the amount of profit they made in their stocks. So,
yeah. Well, you know, sort of looking back on your time at the exchange, and you're essentially doing that. You're sitting there trying to figure out how different ways people are trying to make money
right.
all the time.
And,
was the whole sort of enforcement capability reoriented in any way, or was it really just the same thing from, you know, the mid-1980s to the mid-2000s?
Well, when you talk about enforcement, are you really talking about enforcement, or are you talking about regulation?
Yeah, I guess, I'm sorry, the whole structure, regulation, surveillance, enforcement, everything that you were doing there.
Yeah, well, certainly we became a lot more automated. We try to put everything that we could into an automated system. We substantially increased the enforcement division. When I took over, it had 14 people. When I left, we had 140 or 170 people. And we had a lot of ex-assistant district attorneys and people with great experience in bringing cases and trying them. And we were very successful in the number of cases that we brought and won. So we got a much more powerful enforcement deterrent. And we brought, had, you know, bigger fines and threw people out of business. If a member refused to testify, we would automatically throw them out of the business. So, you know, it's a fair deterrent to, for mm-hmm. them to come forward. On the market surveillance side, we, as the business changed, we tried to... The major market surveillance things were insider trading, and we kept on getting more sophisticated insider trading algorithms to use. And one of, in this Galleon case, they talked about, well, the SEC had this great thing where they have smart investors, but we had that from the late 80s.
Hmm.
You know, people who you couldn't tie in, but were being four or five deals, and you know, you'd say, I just can't tie them in, you know, and you send the names, say, these are really smart investors. And so that's really nothing new. We've had that for years. On the member firm side, there are fewer and fewer broker-dealers out there, the large ones. And there are only about 100 clearing firms, so they carry all of the accounts for all of the other broker-dealers. So that's where we put most of our resources are on the clearing firms because they have all the money and they have all of the stocks. So if there was to be a problem, it would be good to try to get it before it blew up.
You talked about this process early on of meeting with bringing the administration of the stock exchange together with your people and maybe some of the big broker-dealers and trying to figure out where the threshold is. And that suggests that there's sort of gray area, and you have to figure out where to go in that gray area.
Well, we also had this thing called the Financial Surveillance Committee, mm-hmm. which was made up of members, CFOs and the heads of firms, of all different kinds of firms. And we would meet monthly to, and they would give us, you know, one, we would show them which brokers were not doing well, You know, we had criteria that if you lost money for X amount of months, or if your capital went below Y, or various other criteria, and they would give us advice on how to handle it, these brokers, and sometimes the brokers would have to come in and meet their peers who would, you know, tell them that you got to bring yourself up to speed or else you're going to be out of business. And also they would keep us abreast of what was going on, you know, what was the big things that were happening in the industry.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about giving advice, you know, sort of having people self-report what's important, what's happening. And again, that suggests that there's some room for interpretation here and some room to decide where to draw lines. One of my questions would be the administration, the chairman's office, and the direction from the top. Did that ever make a difference as far as how much you pushed or how far you would go or where you draw the lines?
The chairman, the various chairmen that we had, never once told us not to do something. And if they told us anything, it was to do more of what we were doing. During our years, the only part of the exchange that grew was regulation. And it grew substantially, so that we had about almost 700 people by the time I left. So, and it started from the beginning because I told Phelan if he was serious about regulation, then I'd come, and if he wasn't, I wouldn't want to be there, and he wouldn't want me. And Donaldson was fine. He was worried he was going to get in trouble sometime, so he didn't want, you know, he wanted to make sure that we were looking over everyone. And when Dick came in, he was just like John. He thought it was a good selling point to have good, tough regulation. He would use me as a prop sometime, you know, sit there and say, well, you know, if you don't you don't do this, the regulation is going to get you. You know?
So he would tell you to...
Yeah. He never once said, you know, don't do this, even when we were doing the research stuff. And
right.
People like Goldman Sachs were really against us putting in the rules, and he let us go ahead.
That's the post-Sarbanes-Oxley stuff?
Well, we actually were before.
Okay. And you're looking at the research analysts.
Right.
And tell me a little bit about that, because that's a pretty important event.
Well, unlike the newspapers would tell you that it's all Elliot Spitzer, we and the SEC were working on rule proposals, not as extensive, for sure, before Spitzer came out with the Merrill Lynch thing. And a lot of the rules we were working on are the rules that went to effect. So we were aware that there was a problem with research and that the disclosures weren't either enough or accurate enough for someone to pick it up to understand what conflicts were involved. But then we got involved with Spitzer and we and the SEC, and he would have meetings with the Italian Gun Club and wherever else we would have meetings. And we came up with an outline of set of rules, and then we met with all of the large firms, we, the SEC, and the Spitzer's people, and the NASD, and we came up with what we came up with. And our rules actually, most of them predated Sarbanes-Oxley, and then Sarbanes-Oxley came in, and we had another set of rules that we had to change the definition of research report, because we originally had in there that it had to be a recommendation, and Sarbanes-Oxley didn't have that, so we took it out, no use having two different definitions.
Did you ever, you retired from the exchange in 04?
Yes.
Sorry? Did you ever in those few years there's a lot of tumult. NASD, NASDAQ, well, NASD had already done its sort of split offs. It split the
right.
Did you ever think that maybe would be what would happen with the New York Stock Exchange?
Well, not if Dick stayed there.
Yeah.
He was much against that because, again, he believed that having trust and confidence through regulation was a big selling point for the exchange. And so he really didn't want to give up regulation, even though many years it was a substantial cost. Some years we actually had a profit, you know, because we charged a percentage of the gross revenues of the firms as regulatory fee. So when the years were really good, you got a lot of money.
Okay. Tell me about the decision to step down. Was that 65 retirement, or how did that work?
Well, I was, but they were changing. You know, John Reed came in, and I didn't get along with him. And although I did get along, John Thane and I were both on the DTC board for a while, and I got along with him, but it just seemed like it was the time.
Things were really changing.
Yes, they were.
Did you, I guess Rick Ketchum came in after you, is that right? Did you work with him at all or talk to him at all about, you know, this is what you're getting into and these are some of the long-standing
issues? Yeah, well,
issues.
We overlapped for 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
And he and I were both at Market Reg for quite a while. Right. We're both associate directors, so I know Rick for a long time.
Okay. Was there anything else that we've taken a quick run through there. Anything that we've left out that stands out to you?
Yep, I think we've covered the waterfront.
All right. Terrific. Thanks very much.
Good.